You're listening to Liberation News, the newspaper of the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this public forum hosted by the Bay Area Party for Socialism and Liberation. My name is Mimi Chan, and I use she, her pronouns. I'm a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and I will be chairing tonight's event. If this is your first PSL forum, welcome. We are the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and we are active participants and organizers in the growing movement against racist capitalist oppression, fighting on multiple fronts against war, racism, poverty, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, environmental destruction, and more, regardless of who is president. As working class people, we are committed to the socialist transformation of society. Socialism puts the needs of workers and the oppressed first, eliminating the drive for profit that puts the bulk of society's resources and wealth in the hands of a tiny, obscenely rich minority. If you like what you hear tonight, stay in touch with us. The PSL is on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as at PSL Web, and on YouTube as Liberation News. Before we hear from our first presenter tonight, we invite everyone attending to meet up with us in real life at any of the following events and activities. So first is, so every weekend we have outreach teams going out into our different neighborhoods and communities to connect with people on the most pressing issues. It is very important over the next 4 days to get the word out about why we need to vote no on recalling Governor Newsom. You can read our PSL statement on Liberation News about the true undemocratic nature of this recall election. In San Francisco at 1 p.m. tomorrow, Saturday, September 11th, you can join us for our community outreach session in the Mission. We will meet at the PSL office at 2969 Mission Street, between 25th Street and 26th Street. In Oakland at 2 p.m. tomorrow, we will have community outreach at Lake Merritt. We will meet at the pergola close to Lakeshore and Grand at the northeast corner of Lake Merritt. And save the dates for the weekend of September 24th through the 26th, when there will be actions to demand that rents and mortgages be canceled. Also on October 2nd, there will be a day of women's marches against the abortion ban in Texas and the general attack on reproductive rights. Now moving on to our program for the evening. In the United States, we live under a system based on oppression and exploitation. Through struggle, we can make some improvements, but only a revolution can end this oppression. Our first speaker this evening, Patricia Gorky, will explain why a revolution is only possible when led by a militant, class-conscious revolutionary party. Patricia is a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and she is active in many areas of struggle. While Patricia is presenting, if you come up with a question for her, you can type them into the Q&A function on Zoom, not in the chat. So the Q&A function on Zoom is found on the bottom of the Zoom window. Please, everyone, welcome Patricia.
Well, hello, and thank you. It's great to be here. I'm going to drop into the chat, and as I share my screen for my presentation, there is a website where you can join along and leave some reactions and some comments. Go to canva.live and enter the code 484386. That's 484386. And this will give you the opportunity to add some reactions and make this a little more interactive. And so it's great to be here. Again, I'm here to talk about what is a revolutionary party and why we need one. And a revolutionary party is a party of political struggle. It's a party of militant action, but it's also much more than that. A revolutionary party is a party that seeks to lead our class, the working class, in the revolutionary struggles ahead towards the creation of a new society that's based on people's needs and not on profit. This is an enormous task, and fundamentally, without mass struggle, there is no hope for real change. But activism alone is not enough to develop a class-conscious socialist movement. That requires the intervention and the work of a revolutionary party. And a revolutionary party is a multinational party of the multinational working class, which is the vast majority of society who owns nothing but our ability to work. We don't own the factories, we don't own the land, we don't own the machines and the technology. What we do own is our ability to work, and that's what we sell in order to make a living to those who do own. And we engage across all of these struggles that are facing the working class, the women's movement, LGBTQ, Black liberation, climate justice, and much more. And we're all here tonight because we're interested in one way or another about socialism and finding a way forward through the crises that capitalism creates of racism, climate change, misogyny, and anti-LGBTQ bigotry. And we know that capitalism can't exist without these divisions in the working class, without utilizing these weapons against us. And capitalism fundamentally is a system where all the economic activity, the productive forces of society, is oriented to the profit of a few. What does that mean? That means that the only jobs that exist are those that turn a profit. That means that funds and capital is not invested in cleaning up the ocean. It's not invested in stopping all carbon emissions. It's actually put towards exploiting even more and more oil, pulling out even more and more pollution. But it doesn't have to be this way. We don't need to live in a society where 8 people own as much wealth as 3 billion. That's 8 people versus 3,000 million people. We don't need to live in a society where we have to fight police terror, where we have to fight for basic dignity, for housing, for healthcare, and only to have it taken away later, as we're seeing in Texas right now. We don't need to live in a society where $1 trillion every year is spent on war, on death and destruction. And this system where people's needs are met, where healthcare is a right, where housing is a right, this system has a name. That system is socialism. But what is socialism? And if you want, just add a comment and feel free. But what is socialism? Of socialism is fundamentally a system where the productive forces, the factories, the land, the technology, all of that is used to meet the needs of the many. This is not a utopia. This is not a fantasy. This is rather saying that construction, for example, that goes on in your community should be used not for developing ritzy condos, but should be used for housing for the people, where the factories and the technology all around us can actually be used to solve the problems around us. That is socialism, a society where working people are in power. And so the question comes of how do we get there? How do we get there? How do we overturn the dictatorship of the rich? How do we build this new society? Because we're not just here to understand and talk through these problems. We're here to fight and win. And fundamentally, socialism can only be won by the mass movement of millions of people who are organized to fight for what is rightfully theirs. And I want to point out a couple of things. This is actually in our political program. If you go over to PSLweb.org/program, you can find the full political program, including this excerpt. which I highly recommend. But the key here is organization. Organization is key. It's not enough to have just millions of people. We need to be organized. We need to have an understanding of the world situation, an understanding of history. We need to have deep experience in all aspects of the struggle. And we need to be prepared for when periods of revolutionary crises comes that opens a door to revolution, that we're able to succeed. Because there was actually a time where capitalism did not exist. And there was a time under feudalism where the capitalist class was a rising but still oppressed class in Europe. And under feudalism, the capitalists at that time, they were the bankers, they were the merchants who were accumulating wealth and power, and who ultimately overturned the feudal society and by exploiting and taking advantage of the workers. But unlike the capitalist class, the working class is not accumulating ever-increasing wealth in its hands. It's just the opposite. The working class gets poorer every day. So we don't have that advantage. But what is our advantage? Our advantage is our ever-growing numbers, and it's our strategic position in society. But these advantages are only potential strengths unless the working classes are conscious, unless the working classes are organized and ready for a revolutionary crisis. Because how and when a revolutionary crisis comes about is entirely unpredictable. And it's outside of the control of either revolutionaries or the ruling class. What revolutionaries do have some control over, however, is what kind of organization will be available when those revolutionary crises do arise, as they will in this society, as in every other. And ultimately, we need to build now. Because if you wait until that time of the revolutionary crisis, it will be too late. The entire reason for a revolutionary party from the very beginning is preparation for this revolutionary opportunity. The kind of party that's needed really can't be built overnight. It can't even be built in a few years. It has to go through many, many struggles. It has to accumulate all kinds of experiences in those struggles, be tested by developments in the world and develop in 1,000 different ways. In a revolutionary party, it welds together the most developed, most class conscious and determined elements of the working class. And its aim is to represent, promote, and advance the revolutionary, independent class interests of the workers and all oppressed nationalities in the struggle against the monstrous centralism of the imperialist state, to shatter it and destroy the system of capitalist exploitation and slavery. And what's critical and necessary is that we have to be able to stand firmly on principle, but at the same time, to be completely flexible in tactics. We need to be able to formulate demands, to produce literature, to speak, to write, to explain developments in ways that are understandable beyond a very narrow circle of people. We need to be able to reach many, many people with our message. This is critical to be able to do and to be able to organize on this basis, because without a revolutionary party, there can be no revolution. And we know this from lessons of history. In Russia, there was a revolution. That is, the bosses, the capitalists, the big landowners who owned all the property, controlled all the wealth, had all their property and their wealth taken away from them by a new class, the workers. That is, the workers who went into the factories every day to labor, as well as the poor peasants. And up to that point in time, this was the greatest social development in the history of the human race, only rivaled next by the revolution in China in 1949. Just think about it. This was the first time that the oppressed took over. This was the first time in human history that the oppressed, in their own name, as a class of exploited and oppressed people, said, "This society no longer exists for the exploiters and the oppressed. It exists for us, that we, as a working class, have a right to rule rather than be ruled." That's what the workers and peasants did in Russia. They took the old army, smashed it, and built in their place a new popular organ of power, just as they've done in Cuba, and just as they've done in China as well. And with this new power, they took over all of the productive forces of the factories, the office buildings, the mines, the mills. And they said, this is no longer for the profit of capitalists, of billionaires and millionaires, that this productive apparatus will be set into motion for us, for working people, and organized to meet people's needs. That's a fundamentally different social system than any that had previously existed. And with each of these cases, Russia, China, Cuba, these victories were only possible because of the guidance and organization of revolutionary parties. In Russia, the Bolsheviks had earned the workers' and peasants' trust and were able to put forward strategies, tactics, and slogans that could advance the struggle for socialism at a time when other parties were seeking to hold back and work within the system. So I want to fast forward to another lesson, and this is from 10 years ago, and looking at the role or the absence of a revolutionary party in a time of struggle, and what effect that had. And of course, Occupy, this was just 10 years ago. And in many ways, there are similarities that draw forward to today. But the Occupy movement, in which our party was very active, it spread like wildfire across the country, and it was really part of a worldwide trend. And there are a number of lessons that we can draw from this as well. Up here, we had hundreds of thousands of people who were drawn into activism, and many for the first time. This was a tremendous development with lasting political impact. But the lack of any centralized national or leadership structures made it much easier for the federal government and local police to attack Occupy. In what was a nationally coordinated plan, Occupy encampments were dismantled one by one by local governments. And after these extensive preparations were kept secret until the moment of attack. Obama famously gathered together actually all of the mayors onto a conference call and talked about, we need to shut this down, we need to crush this, and they did. Fundamentally, the movement had no plan to retreat, regroup, or refocus in an organized way. And so instead of a nationwide struggle against what was clearly an orchestrated attack, each local Occupy group was basically left on its own. Fundamentally, success in confronting the bureaucratically and militarily centralized capitalist state, it's not possible without a centralized working class party and movement. And we need to understand this because this is essential to building an organization that's able to defend itself against the inevitable attacks by the government. And of course, right now, we're not in a revolutionary crisis. You know, there are not tens or hundreds of millions of people in the streets. And so what does a revolutionary party do in non-revolutionary times? Well, we need to understand and assess the world situation. We know that capitalism is a system that's built on crisis, is a system of crisis, that cannot rationally handle surplus, that is no solution. That has no solution to automation, that's rendering millions of jobs obsolete. During the 2008 recession, 3 million jobs disappeared, just completely disappeared. And with automation, as automation advances, the number of jobs that are going away and only going to be replaced by piecework will increase. So capitalism has no solution for the vast majority of humanity other than destitution and poverty. That's what answer it has. Capitalism has no solution to climate change. In fact, it's capitalism that's causing and exacerbating climate change. Every piece of production, and when we think about as well of the struggle over climate change is a struggle over production, is a class war, because fundamentally it's the capitalists who decide what is produced. It's the capitalists who decide to pump out as much oil as possible. And of course, the US military is the biggest, the single largest institutional polluter in the world. So with fires happening, with floods, with hurricanes, we know that we're heading into crisis. But what do we do right now? Do we just wait for a revolutionary crisis? If we wait, it'll be too late. We need to build a revolutionary party. preparing for the revolution is what a revolutionary party does. That's what we're doing today. And that's what we do in everything that we do. This is why we have organizing meetings, educational classes, protests, and street meeting. This is why we're holding this study group tonight. We're learning the lessons of past movements and revolutions while being involved in the most critical struggles of the day and where there is class struggle and deepening conflict, which is everywhere. We're fighting to promote a revolutionary outlook in reform movements that pop up spontaneously to the crises that we're facing, like the campaign to cancel rents and mortgages, like the campaign for women's rights and the right to reproductive health care, the right to abortion, as well as the anti-war movement and the struggles against racism and all forms of oppression. We have to be involved in all of these struggles because it's relatively easy to proclaim oneself to be revolutionary, a socialist, and an anti-imperialist. But if there's not also the capacity to mobilize and to organize, what does it really mean? The kind of party that we're building and that we need to build can't be built overnight. Again, a revolutionary party has to go through many struggles, has to develop all kinds of experiences in these struggles and be tested through world developments. And we need to develop in all of these different ways. We need more members. We need more organizers in unions, on campuses, in all communities. We're organizing to meet the challenges that lie ahead. And as a revolutionary party, the PSL is working hard to find people like all of you who want to be revolutionaries and fight for workers' power and fight for socialism. And there are many people, including progressive people, who really believe that revolution is just not possible here in the US, that it just can't happen. The US has too many massive problems and contradictions, and all of these problems, by the way, which can only really be solved by revolution. And they say, well, it can just never happen here. But as a South African revolutionary said, the apartheid system in South Africa also seemed it would never go away. Would never come to an end. But after it did, he said, every revolution is impossible until it happens. And then it was always inevitable. I'd like to thank you again for coming to this meeting tonight. If you're interested in joining the Party for Socialism and Liberation, send us an email, fill out an application at pslweb.org/join and get involved in the struggle. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Comrade Patricia. That was such an inspiring and incredibly important speech. If we wait, it will be too late. So we really have to get organized and build. So we have a few moments for, we have time to get some comments and questions in to the Q&A. We'll answer those after we hear from our second speaker. We encourage everyone here to check out The Socialist Program with Brian Becker, a news podcast about the world for those who want to change it. It airs 3 times a week on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. The topics covered this week include the abortion ban in Texas and the Supreme Court striking down the eviction moratorium. Yesterday's program on September 9th commemorated the 50th anniversary of the Attica Prison Rebellion, which is really important to remember because that is something that corporate media still can't whitewash and make palatable for mass consumption. You can hear you can listen to the Socialist Program on SoundCloud or Spotify or however you listen to podcasts. Now onto our second presentation of tonight. Past and present US officials are blaming each other for their defeat in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the corporate media are portraying the brutal 20-year occupation as a humanitarian mission and an attempt to modernize the country. Our second speaker tonight is Mazda Majidi, who will talk about how the Taliban are themselves a direct result of U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, and what led to the complete failure of this U.S. imperialist project. Mazda is a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. He was born and raised in Iran and travels there often. He frequently writes on the Middle East for Liberation News and is the co-author of the PSL book, Socialists and War. Mazda is speaking to us tonight from Southern Oregon. If you think of a question while the speaker is presenting, you can type it into the Q&A function on Zoom, not in our chat. And we will have time for comments and questions after both speakers present. Please welcome Mazda.
Thank you, Mimi. Good evening, comrades, friends, sisters, brothers. About 3 weeks ago, we also held a meeting on this topic. It was very shortly after the collapse of the government of Mohammad Ashraf Ghani. And in that talk, in that discussion, we mainly focused, at least a big part of the discussion was focused on what a tremendous defeat this was for U.S. imperialism and the idea of bombing and invading and occupying countries, coming behind similar defeats in Iraq and Libya and now Afghanistan. Now, they've been successful as far as destroying their targeted countries are concerned, but as far as the success that they were looking for in terms of setting up client states who would be do the bidding for Washington and, you know, open the markets and resources to the corporations, they have been abysmal failures. And the case of Afghanistan is even a more direct example of that than the previous. So tonight, what we're going to try to do is talk about some of the real facts, some of the real history of Afghanistan that we seldom ever hear on the corporate media and the narratives that have emerged in covering Afghanistan. So we will talk about that narrative and we will debunk some major components of it. We feel like these are the types of things that we need to be able to talk to people about as the topic continues to be a major topic of discussion. Okay, I will explain a little further about this photo that we're looking at right now. So again, we know that the occupation regime collapsed, and I call it the occupation regime. They had three elections, but I think in the eyes of the Afghan people, it was very clear that these were individuals who worked mainly at the service of the U.S. occupying forces. In the case of Hamid Karzai, the president, who, by the way, the airport, Kabul airport, is named after, he was literally airlifted into Afghanistan. He was, I think, a mid-level executive in UNOCAL in the U.S. And as part of this project of destroy and put in your own person, Karzai was their man, and then he, you know, they had the elections and so forth. Even as far as elections goes, every election that was held, despite the very limited choices that people had, there was wide-scale reports of abnormalities and fraud in those elections. The military disintegrated. They just fell apart. They never fought, really. And considering the level of military equipment and supposedly the great training that they had received from the U.S., and the numbers, as many as 350,000 military personnel and police, going against the number of Taliban fighters, which was significantly smaller, maybe 100 to 150,000. This is very telling of how limited the utility of a military setup and a whole government setup by occupying forces is. Ashraf Ghani actually left Afghanistan based on somewhat of a false report. I think he fled maybe a few hours before he actually had to, but he fled. Some of his advisors didn't even know he had fled. The reports, because he He fled with suitcases of money, and there was some reports of some of the cash being spread in their, you know, rush to get to the plane on the tarmac of the airport. But that tells you something about the character of this individual and the types of individuals who were charged in Afghanistan under the occupation regime. Now, the coverage that we received in the U.S. for days on end was the Americans and their, you know, and supposedly all Afghans rushing to the airport. Well, it's obvious why the Americans wanted to leave as part of the 20-year-long occupation force. But just like the colonial powers of the old, the U.S. occupation, along with its junior imperialist partners, the U.S.'s junior imperialist partners, you know, they had a number of people, not just interpreters and translators, but, you know, there were servers, there were people around them, there were advisors, there were people who knew the area. And of course, maybe a layer of the intelligentsia of the educated who were in support of the U.S. But the notion that, and this was kind of the narrative that like all Afghans are trying to rush to the airport, is patently false. If for no other reason, but for the fact that, you know, how would you get on the planes if you are not identified by the Americans as people having worked with them? Having said that, of course, given the extremely poor conditions of life, the poverty, the hunger, everything else, many, many Afghans who can, pretty much every Afghan who can, has tried to leave the country. There are millions of Afghans living in neighboring Iran, neighboring Pakistan, and many other places. The conditions have been bad, very, very bad for a very, very long time. And as we'll discuss it in a little bit, the U.S. is directly responsible for those conditions. I have a few statistics that I wanted to run by people just to give us a picture. These numbers were put together by the Brown University Costs of War Project. And of course, numbers, collecting statistics is very difficult. And I strongly suspect that these numbers, as well as many others, are severe undercounts due to the difficulty of gathering the information. But anyway, I'll just go through them just to give us an idea of what these numbers look like. The number of Afghan civilians died who have been killed is 47,245. These are in the 20 years of the U.S. occupation. The number of Taliban fighters, 51,191. American service members, through April of last year, 2,448. U.S. contractors, and I was actually kind of surprised by this number, is 3,846 U.S. contractors have been killed. Afghan military and police, these are the same people that have been trained by the U.S., 66,000. Like the British and other allies of the U.S. in the occupation, they've lost 444 aid workers and 72 journalists have been killed. Now, just to give people an idea of how long this occupation went on, about one out of every four Americans was not even born when the U.S. started its occupation in Afghanistan in 2001. The cost of the war costs of Iraq and Afghanistan combined, I haven't been able to find reliable numbers sorted between the two, but the cost between the two occupations, Afghanistan and Iraq, is $2 trillion. The interest, because it's all borrowed money, U.S. government essentially printing dollars, but with the interest costs, it'll be $6.5 trillion by 2050. So these are some of the indications of how costly this occupation has been. Now, one of the things that the U.S. has just done is that the U.S. has blocked the assets of Afghanistan in which were mostly held in Federal Reserve and other banks. Of course, the Europeans have done the same thing, but it's a couple of billion there. And it's a continuation that we see in the case of Venezuela and other places where countries have to, in order to engage in international trade, they have to have dollars in Western banks, and the U.S. in particular, but also the Europeans, see it as their prerogative to freeze their assets whenever they don't like the government running a given country. And this is actually very, very huge. Many, many Western analysts have predicted an extreme increase in poverty and possibly hyperinflation in the months to come because they've frozen all of their assets. And of course, in recent days, the Taliban has formed a new government, a new caretaker government. They've announced some of the officials. The caretaker prime minister is a person by the name of Akhund. The deputy prime minister is a person by the name of Baradar. These were known figures among the leadership of the Taliban over the last few years. Now, the narrative, and this is almost across the board, the white man's burden that is in the corporate media, the idea that, well, we went there to help these backward Afghans, but, you know, they weren't able to take full advantage of our efforts. Some of the more right-wing elements say, well, they didn't really quite deserve our help. And like the more moderate ones, maybe the Democrats would be a little more polite. You wouldn't say that, but that's part of the narrative. We, the U.S., we went there, tried to help these people, but they, you know, they really didn't know anything about the rule of law, about the norms of democracy, about how to build a modern society. And despite our best efforts and the fact that many, many elements, our allies and our interpreters understood these concepts, most of the Afghan society didn't understand it, and you know, so it didn't work after 20 years of our best efforts. Along with that, and even the airport, the coverage of the people rushing for the airport indirectly feeds the notion that things were kind of good, things were okay when the U.S. was in. People were reasonably happy, things were, you know, going along until the Taliban came in. And the U.S. is pretty much portrayed, instead of, you know, the reality, which is the U.S. having occupied Afghanistan for nearly a few months short of 20 years, it's like, you know, they were there to help people along and build some infrastructure and get some nonprofits to bring some resources there. That's what they were doing. They were just kind of helping out. Society was generally peaceful, even though the Taliban just disturbed the peace. This is another thing that's very interesting. One of the things that I was thinking about the other day is, I mean, to this day, anything that goes wrong, the U.S. blames on the Taliban. The U.S. was in Afghanistan, occupied and controlled Afghanistan for 20 years, and the Taliban really controlled Afghanistan for 5 years. And if we extend the Mujahideen before their reign to the Taliban, that's another 4 years. That's 9 years total from the time they overthrew the revolutionary government of Afghanistan, which we'll talk about. The Taliban had 5 years and the Mujahideen had four. And 20 years later, every problem that exists in Afghanistan, the U.S. is blaming on the Taliban, which is very interesting. I mean, the Taliban certainly are no revolutionary force, but it's very interesting how an arrogant imperialist power, after a 20-year occupation, is still blaming everything on a force that only had 5 years in power and had been out of power for 20 years. Another thing, of course, and we see that in not just in the pages of Wall Street Journal, but in other sources, is, yeah, we were teaching the Afghans the values of entrepreneurship. They were learning about the lessons of capitalism. The economy was getting better, but you know what? The project was interrupted. And of course, the other thing that we'll talk about is that, you know, we, the occupying forces, supposedly we had liberated the Afghan women. And we'll talk about how false that claim is as well. But one of the things that is very, very important, and you could read dozens of articles and watch dozens of news pieces and analysis and talking heads talking about Afghanistan, there's hardly any mention of how the U.S. got involved in Afghanistan to begin with. And it didn't start in 2001. It started long before then. And here is where we need to talk about the Sour Revolution, what was called the Sour Revolution. Sour is the name of a month in the Afghan calendar, the April Revolution in 1978. What happened in that revolution and how the U.S. overthrew it? Again, you could read the U.S. coverage and not even know that such a thing even existed. You will hear about the supposed Soviet invasion and occupation, which it was not, but you won't hear that there was a revolution in this country. A lot of actually revolutionary developments took place during that period. So let me just say this. There was the force that led the revolution in April of 1978 was a left party by the name of PDPA. And it was actually emerging of two Afghan leftist forces. So as we watch the video is the 1 year anniversary of the 1978 revolution. I'm going to try to explain some of the scenes. It has music, but I'm hoping that people can see even 1 year after the revolution, since in our minds, based on Western coverage, we don't see anything about this period. Every time we see Afghanistan, we just see the Taliban and the Mujahideen. I thought it would be useful to look at that. So the PDPA, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, was the party that was in charge from the 1978 revolution until the U.S. Funded Mujahideen overthrew them, many years later, 1996. So if we could run that video, please. The party gatherings after the 1978 revolution. I believe this one is from 1979 or 1980. This is Babrak Karmel. He was the president of Afghanistan during some of those years. He was later replaced by Dr. Najibullah, who himself stayed and fought to the end. Najibullah did until he was hanged in a street in Kabul when the Taliban came in. March at the city center in Kabul. Notice the presence of revolutionary women. The sign says, "Long live the PDPA."
Afghanistan,
These are all pictures during the period when the PDA government was in power. The power of unity is what the sign says. Training teachers, mainly for the countryside. Okay, so the revolution's accomplishments, there are many, but one of the things that happened, Afghanistan is a primarily agrarian country, and one of the problems that the revolutionaries saw was the extreme underdevelopment of the countryside. Virtually the whole population was illiterate. The land, up to 85% of the land, was owned by rich landlords who, by the way, aside from imperialist patronage, were the social base of the opposition to the revolution. But there are many beautiful, beautiful stories of teachers, many women teachers going to the most remote areas, teaching children, including girls. There are clinics with doctors and nurses that were set up, again, in areas where they had previously no access to healthcare and so forth. Tremendous progress was made in this period under the revolution leadership of the PDPA. Yet, as you might imagine, just like the rest of the world, the U.S. didn't stand by while a country was making progress, particularly the workers and peasants in the country. So the U.S. started, the U.S. really founded, they organized the Mujahideen, whom they called the Freedom Fighters, and they started funding them, which it was the largest CIA operation, and it lasted for years and years. Now, in the U.S., up to years later, the idea was that the U.S. started funding and training and arming the Mujahideen to fight the so-called U.S. invasion. The exact opposite is true. The reason that the PDPA really insisted, despite a lot of resistance on the part of the Soviet leadership, the PDPA insisted on the Soviet military coming to their aid is that they weren't strong enough to be able to fight against the Mujahideen because they were heavily armed and heavily trained by the U.S. Brzezinski and others later had to admit that this was a trap, and the fact that they actually started arming the opposition to the revolution, the Mujahideen, before the Soviets came in. And of course, the Soviets had no territorial ambitions. The Soviet assistance lasted through 1989, and that's a kind of a long discussion. There was, of course, the Gorbachev leadership in the Soviet Union, and the fact that it had been a long and costly military engagement on the part of the Soviet Union, but they withdrew in 1989. Now, at the time, similar to now, a lot of people predicted that the Mujahideen would take over in a matter of days. All right, so the U.S., of course, continued supporting and funding the Mujahideen, but the revolutionary government fought on. And despite, because it had a strong base of revolutionaries who mainly are almost exclusively based in the cities. And even though they had made much progress in bringing many things that didn't exist to the countryside, also including a very progressive land reform, including forgiving the debts of the peasantry to the landlords and so forth, still the Mujahideen were heavily armed, well-trained, and continued to receive training. So, so it was in 1992 that the Mujahideen took over. Again, the Mujahideen were really all the U.S. And from 1992 to 1996, the Mujahideen, many of the leaders of whom right now are forming the people that the U.S. again is defending, like in the North, it used to be called the Northern Alliance and so forth. And then what happened was that in 1996, the Taliban, which itself could be considered a faction of the Mujahideen, certainly the leaders, including Mullah Omar, were among the leaders of the Mujahideen. They were mainly funded and organized in Pakistan by the inter-service intelligence. And at the time, Pakistan, even more so than now, was a client of the U.S. But part of the problem under the Mujahideen was that they didn't have a structure of leadership that was unified, and murder and rape and all kinds of problems were vastly happening all across the country. And the Taliban, who were part of the same force, brought in and brought some level of stability to the situation. This is 1996. And of course, we know about September 11, which, 20th anniversary is tomorrow. And of course, the U.S. under Bush 2 and Rumsfeld and Powell and the rest of them, Cheney, used that as an excuse to start a new round of imperialist aggression. And Afghanistan was their first target. And of course, from that point on, nearly 20 years of occupation. Okay, so we have one of the things that's missing from the corporate media coverage, of course, is how little they're talking about, not which people got killed in attacks and fights by the Taliban, but how many people the U.S. outright killed with its own bombings. We have two. I'm thinking in the interest of time, we can only show one of them. So maybe we can go to this one, which is a bombing in Kandahar in 2008. Of course, there's way, way too many of these examples, unfortunately, throughout the 20 years of the occupation. But if we could show that, please, Nick.
As the U.S. celebrated the election of a new president, these Afghans searched for dead bodies after a U.S. airstrike hit a wedding party. It happened in a village near Kandahar. A member of parliament from the area says 35 civilians were killed and 38 injured. But there's another 50 people unaccounted for, potentially buried beneath the rubble.
A lot of people died. We were going to a wedding. We were 12 family members. Only four of us survived. And it was like doomsday. They bombed us from 3 o'clock in the morning till late evening.
The bride is among the injured in Kandahar Hospital, along with other women and children. Many of them say they were attending the wedding party when Taliban fighters attacked US troops nearby, who then called in fighter jets for support. A US military statement confirmed an operation in this area and claimed the Taliban prevented civilians from fleeing when the fighting began. An investigation into the claims of civilian deaths is underway, but the incident has already been condemned by President Hamid Karzai.
The civilian casualties must be ended in Afghanistan. My first demand from the newly elected president of America is to end the civilian casualties in Afghanistan and take the war to the safe havens and training camps of terrorism.
This incident comes less than 3 months after an Afghan government commission found that a US operation in western Afghanistan killed some 90 civilians. The US at first denied that any civilians had been killed, but after two investigations and the emergence of photographic evidence of dozens of bodies, including children, the US said that 33 civilians had died. Dan Nolan, Al Jazeera.
Okay, the next one, we had one, another very painful mass killing in Kunduz in 2016, which in the interest of time, we're probably going to skip. But again, this kind of stuff happened all through the 20 years. And the US basically, they were using Afghanistan as the testing grounds, the so-called mother of all bombs, an 18,000-pound bomb, 18,000-pound bomb, the biggest non-nuclear bomb exploded was dropped on Afghanistan. Again, and every time they did that, it was the Taliban. Now, in the second video that we didn't watch, the locals were saying there was no Taliban, and they killed over 50 people, family members, and so forth. And the U.S., approach generally denied, ignored. We don't know anything that has happened, or it was the Taliban. And sometimes there was video evidence. Then, and not only that, but it had to be video evidence of women and children. If you were a male and you were killed by the U.S. bombing, you were the Taliban, so it was all okay. But sometimes they had to acknowledge them. But for the most part, they denied and ignored and tried to hide the fact. And certainly this didn't make it to the mainstream news media in the US very often. And the other thing is the occupation, which again, the recent coverage, media coverage, makes it sound like they were so popular. In fact, it's the opposite, despite the overwhelming advantage of the Afghan forces in terms of training and equipment and weaponry and numbers and bases and everything. Many areas of Afghanistan, even long before the U.S. left recently, were under the control of the Taliban. And it's not so much that the Taliban were so popular, it's that the occupation was almost universally hated by the Afghan people. And, you know, that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. Now, the other component is that we're supposed to think that, you know, things were kind of humming along as the U.S. was there. And we could use this, just a short video on poverty from the February of this year, actually.
Get stabbed or shot by a thief and get killed.
Afghan politicians have told Al Jazeera that rampant corruption, inadequacies and nepotism have pushed Afghanistan towards unseen levels of desperation. In the last 8 years, more than 5 million people have been displaced from their homes. Despite billions of dollars in aid, a staggering 72% of Afghanistan's population lives in poverty. Now, with the COVID-19 pandemic, UN relief workers say 4 out of 10 Afghans suffer from hunger every day. Nearly 40% of Afghans are unemployed, but the ones with jobs are scared every time they go to work.
We spend the whole day in fear, panic and concern. Our lives are in real danger. Therefore, due to these problems, I had to send my family somewhere else so we can limit our movement in and around the house. Due to this fear, life has become hell for us.
No peace means no justice. Injustice means no economic opportunity. And a lack of prospects often means crimes and corruption. Until that cycle is broken, many Afghans believe their future remains bleak. Osama bin Javed, Al Jazeera.
Okay, and just a couple of numbers on the poverty in Afghanistan. It's according to World Bank estimates, Afghanistan, this is in 2020, overall poverty level increased from 55% to 72% in 2020. 55% to 72%. Now, the former president, Mohammad Ashraf Ghani, actually said in 2020 that 90% of Afghans lived below the government-determined poverty level of $2 a day. 90%, this is according to the president at the time. And in terms of hunger and food insecurity, I have another statistics. Between November 2020 and March 2021, around 13.15 million people, that's 42% of the population, it was predicted that they were likely to experience high levels of acute food insecurity. This is according to Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC. So this supposed paradise that the occupation had created, the U.S. occupation had created for the Afghan people, this is what it looked like on the ground. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is this notion that the U.S. occupation was so good for the women of Afghanistan. It's very interesting that these, including journalists and liberals and so forth, who do talk about very, very limited gains in Kabul and maybe the vicinity for mainly well-to-do and educated women, they talk about that, but they fail to mention much more far encompassing gains of the women in Afghanistan during the revolutionary period. They don't even mention that at all. If we could, this is pretty short, and I'm probably going to wrap it up pretty shortly, but if we could show this video, part of this video of the women in Afghanistan.
Kabbalah's unique access allowed her to document a side of Afghan life that is rarely seen by the West.
There were so many women's issues to document and stories to be told. Poverty, forced marriages, many of them being child brides, the abuse that goes on within the household that nobody sees, physical abuse, mental abuse, domestic violence in general. No one felt it was important to have an educated woman. So quite a few of them are illiterate.
Low levels of literacy and old social stigmas that surround the idea of working women meant that the majority of Afghan families rely almost exclusively on a man's income. However, the number of wars over the last three decades has meant that many women have been left widowed and without a household income.
What happens to women who don't have a male who dictates their life? All of a sudden there's an uneducated woman who has to try to feed her kids. How's she doing it? Women's issue is, here's the legacy of the war, the country.
Okay, just a couple of numbers. The child mortality rate in Afghanistan is 47.4 deaths per 1,000 live births, which is one of the highest in the world. This is after 20 years of supposedly modernizing U.S. occupation. Maternal mortality rate in Afghanistan is 638 deaths per 100,000. Which is four times the world average of 211 per 100,000. And of course, it goes far beyond that. The poverty and hunger and food security that we talked about, along with other forms of oppression, affects women harder than men. And as in all societies, poverty disproportionately affects women. So this notion that Afghanistan was so good for women under the U.S. is completely false. Revolutionary government did something very revolutionary, and that is, like we discussed earlier, went to the countryside, provided healthcare, provided education, brought the women in many instances into the workforce, and that's something that the occupation regime didn't and couldn't do, frankly. So just to wrap up, of course, the future of Afghanistan, for all the reasons we discussed, it seems very, very challenging. Crises awaits the people of Afghanistan. We strongly believe in the right of self-determination, meaning it is the Afghan people who determine their own future, their leadership, their policies, and so forth. We have to acknowledge that through not 20, but 40 years of imperialist intervention in Afghanistan, there's been, progressive forces, the communists, socialists, the trade unionists, and so forth, have been almost completely annihilated. So it's going to be a long, difficult road ahead for all the reasons that Patricia pointed out in her great talk. In order for society to get ahead, it needs the political leadership of a revolutionary party. And that's something that the U.S. obliteration of the country has made at this moment impossible. Of course, we're optimistic and it will happen, but it will take years and years in struggle and hard work. Any calls for the U.S. to go in and fight the Taliban is a complete it's disregarding completely the murderous role that the U.S. has played in Afghanistan in the past 20 years. The U.S. is, and the U.S. and other imperialist powers, but the U.S. as the leader of world imperialism and as the leader of the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, has the largest responsibility in the misery that has put the people of Afghanistan in. The U.S. is not going to be the solution to this problem. So what we demand, what we in the PSL demand, is U.S. hands of Afghanistan, no talk of going back in, bombing, more sanctions and so forth. And it goes beyond that. We call for reparations to the Afghan people in order to make up for some of the unimaginable crimes that the U.S. 20 years of occupation has done. So U.S. hands of Afghanistan, reparations to the Afghan people, and I'll stop it there. Thank you, Mimi.
Thank you so much, Comrade Mazda. Indeed, U.S. hands off Afghanistan and reparations to the Afghan people. Before we take questions, we invite everyone to check out the Party for Socialism and Liberation bookstore at store.pslweb.org. In addition to finding Mazda's book, Socialists and War, you can also purchase copies of Breaking the Chains magazine, our socialist feminist publication. In particular, check out the issue titled Not a Moral Issue, which articulates a Marxist understanding of reproductive rights and a socialist feminist perspective towards building the movement needed to defend Roe v. Wade and expand the struggle for women's liberation. So we have some time now for questions and comments, and we'll go ahead and gather a few questions and then ask for Mazda and Patricia to respond. So the questions that we've submitted so far is, we've already have a lot of questions, so we'll only have time for the questions that are already submitted. So I'm gonna go ahead and start reading. So the first question that we have up here is, in what ways did party centralization make the George Floyd uprising stronger? And in what ways did the lack of centralization lead to the weakness, contribute to weaknesses in the George Floyd uprising? And another question for Mazda. Why are they referring to the quote unquote caretaker government? Does that mean they are anticipating elections to elect a new quote unquote regular government? And I'm gonna ask two more questions for now. Will large civil wars between the Taliban and other tribes be developing in the next few years, or will there just be continual small tribal skirmishes? And let me just read these for now and have Patricia and Mazda, if you would like to take these first few questions.
Sure thing. So thank you, Mimi, and thank you, Mazda. And of course, the struggle here at home is so deeply connected to the anti-imperialist struggle, because the imperialist occupations really mirror the reality for people who live, who are in oppressed communities here in this country. And one clear example, of course, of Israeli occupation forces that train American police. And so, you know, our solidarity is really with working people of the world, working people around the world. Our enemies are not in the poorest countries. Our enemies are right here in the richest one. And to the question of the lessons from 2020 and some of the topics around centralization and party structure. In terms of understanding the rebellion against racism, the amazing, you know, I think we all know of how much society has changed fundamentally. Like, there have been such big shifts in our world because of the struggle. And I want to repeat that. The shifts that have happened, both in terms of consciousness and what is acceptable and what is no longer acceptable, is because of the mass movement of people that flooded the streets of tens of millions all over the country and the world, in fact, protesting racism, police brutality, and police terror. And yet, of course, what hasn't changed? The system is still the same system. We still have police killings that happen every single day, just about. And in fact, the day that the Chauvin verdict came out, which only came about because of the struggle of the people, and that is a victory. But the only reason that verdict came out because of that struggle, on that same day, police in another city murdered a 15-year-old Black girl. And so this points again of, in terms of when we bring out, when people come out all over the country, of that mobilization, activism, protests is, you know, we need activism. We need people in political motion, but it's not enough. We need a revolutionary party. We need a revolutionary party that can provide leadership and direction. And this is not some elitist aspect. The idea is that we need to have a revolutionary direction, because if we're not looking in a revolutionary way, if we're not thinking and don't have the revolutionary ideas, then, you know, what possibilities are there? There are none. If we don't have that possibility, if we aren't looking continually of how can we push the struggle for socialism, how can we point to the structure of capitalism as really the fundamental issue here to unite all of our forces? I will say as well, in terms of, and there are a number of statements that we put out during the uprising. I'm going to drop one just right here, which is from Rebellion to Revolution. Which is written at the end of June, and really a great statement covering of the development of rebellions and of what it means to fight for revolution, and in terms of the party and our organization during that time, I think this actually shows of really the validity and the necessity of organizing on the basis of a revolutionary party. Because what happened during that time? Of course, you know, during 2020, there were all of these pivots, giant pivots that we had to make. And it's kind of hard to think back to January 2020. But if you remember, the US had just assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the top military general of Iran. And we were very much on the brink of another major war in the Middle East. And our organization mobilized all across the country, in more than 90 cities, of demonstrations against war. And people came out. People came out in the thousands and thousands protesting this war that even, you know, carried internationally. And then, of course, and this only happens, you know, when we talk about being flexible on tactics, but firm in political orientation, this can only happen if if we're able to move, if we're able to be flexible and adjust to the many issues that arise. A second major development was the pandemic, of course, that has changed the world landscape. And then, of course, with the eviction crisis that developed, and I want to bring up again of with the uprising. When the uprising happened, that was another huge moment, right, of people all over the country in political motion. I want to say too, a revolutionary party does not make the revolution; the people make revolution. What a revolutionary party does is provide again the direction of being able to coalesce all of the experience from past struggles that we're involved in, either struggles for reforms or for other demands or organizing workers, but bring together all these different experiences and combine them into the struggle for socialism, because that struggle is not going to come from anywhere else. That struggle is not going to happen naturally or spontaneously. And in fact, of one thing that we did see, again, was such an amazing feat of tens of millions of people out in the streets spontaneously protesting, bravely fighting for justice that has transformed the world and has transformed so much. And yet there is still, you know, we're still under capitalism. And so these are some of the considerations that come forward. And I want to highlight just one other aspect too that I think really came out during the rebellion and the uprising is really of highlighting the nature of the state. And what is the state? And if you remember during that time of there were all these cops who, like, as these protests were happening, there are all these cops who would like go out and they were like handing out water bottles. This didn't happen everywhere, but it happened in some places. And they made sure to post photos on TikToks of cops dancing and really of trying to blur the line. But as time went on, of course, it became more and more apparent of you know, who is siding with the police. Of which side are the police on? What do the police represent? And in fact, of course, what do the courts represent? What do the judges represent? The district attorneys? These all form part of the state, of that repressive apparatus, the military, the courts, the prisons, that are there not as a form of profit, but as a tool of the capitalist class that has to be smashed, that can't be reformed, that can't be simply abolished. That can only happen through a revolution, through a struggle for a socialist revolution. So I'll leave it right there.
Okay, Mimi, should I proceed?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'll try to keep it brief. One question, and it's very relevant, is why are they referring to the caretaker government? Does that mean they are anticipating elections to elect a new, quote, regular government? Yes, what the Taliban, in particular, Baradar, who's now the deputy prime minister, and he served as the effective spokesperson for the Taliban, has said things about an election. And we have to say that the Taliban seem to have had, you know, plenty of time, and for good reason, of knowing that this was going to happen. So they seem to have planned it. They seem to know what they were going to do. They declared an amnesty for everyone, including the people who had worked directly with the occupation forces. And they've kept their word so far. So the thing about elections, and of course, that's not what the questioner is suggesting, but we need to be clear, because in the U.S., we're effectively told that, you know, people walking up to a poll is the highest form of the rule of people. The reality is that the system that's in place manages the election, decides who can or cannot go on. In the case of the U.S., this is controlled by the primary system and the billions of dollars involved. But, you know, the Taliban, just like the occupation regime the last 20 years, they can hold elections too. So I wouldn't be surprised if they did hold elections. There's a question about, will there be large civil wars between the Taliban and other tribes? Well, of course, I don't know for sure, but the thing to keep in mind is that it had turned into various warlords. This is prior to 1996, when the Taliban came over, took over, and when the Taliban came in, it was pretty centralized and much more organized. So I would suspect, with the Taliban having in effect led the opposition to the occupation, I would suspect that the Taliban are probably strong enough for it not to dissolve into period of small skirmishes between different warlords and so forth. Another question is, the U.S. military leaders knew more than 10 years ago that they couldn't be victorious. Why did they continue all these years? And you know, it's very interesting. This is a very important point. I mean, for a few years, they were saying, well, we won't the U.S. Leaders were saying, we won't negotiate with terrorists and so forth. And then they negotiated. And even the ultra-right-wing government of Trump reached an agreement with the Taliban, which resulted in what we see today. But I suspect beyond Afghanistan itself, they were concerned, the imperialist leaders were concerned of how this looks. And it looks pretty bad for them, because what they want and what they've tried very, very strongly to portray from themselves an image of being invincible. Nobody can confront us. Resistance is futile. What we say goes, and we've got the military to prove it. And the case of the 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, and the fact that it's not only was the U.S. defeated, but the very Taliban came back to power, is as complete a defeat as you can imagine. So I suspect that they didn't want that to happen, because we know about imperialism that it is addicted to war because it needs to promote its interest, the interest of big capital. And if occupation after occupation does not produce their desired results, it basically strengthens the hands of those around the world who are resisting imperialism. The last comment is, the last question is, that a number of people are responding to the Taliban takeover by saying that the U.S. and its allies must, quote, do something. How should we respond to that? And I think that's actually a good question to respond to for ending our discussion. I mean, I think the first thing we should say is that the U.S. is responsible for what's happened to Afghanistan. If the U.S. is responsible for what's happened, if the U.S. is responsible for all these crimes, if the U.S. is directly responsible for the Mujahideen and the Taliban coming into power, how could the U.S. possibly be part of the solution? Again, that's, I think then we'd have to explain what has to happen in terms of developments in the class struggle within Afghanistan. And again, like I said, I don't anticipate a very many positive developments in the short term. In response to another question, safe zones and discussions and things like that, the problem is that the multilateralism dialogue and so forth has no possibility of happening in a vacuum. It happens in a world dominated by imperialism, not just U.S. imperialism, but the Europeans and the rest. And in the case of Afghanistan, we have Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates, who are funding various reactionary forces off and on for the last 40 years and so forth. So, discussion alone, since it can't happen outside of the class struggle, both within Afghanistan and within the global forces that happen, is something that if it did happen, it would only stop at discussion. In class struggle, you have to have actual forces, which is in the U.S. and around the world, what we're struggling for is the working class and the oppressed being organized so that we can exercise our power through our numbers and through our organization. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you so much, comrade. That is all the time we have for this Q&A section. Thank you so much to everyone who participated by submitting like really great questions and commentary. If you like what you heard today and want to learn more, don't forget to check out Liberation News for a socialist perspective on current events and reporting from the front lines of the struggle. And I would like to thank our presenters again for sharing this essential political analysis and calls to action tonight. And I want to thank everyone who attended and participated. If you're interested in joining the PSL, you can go to pslweb.org/join to apply, and an organizer will connect you to get you started on that exciting conversation. And once again, thank you all for joining tonight's event, and we hope to see you at outreach and other actions in the coming weeks. Our next virtual forum is currently scheduled for Friday, September 24th. The topic will be on the role of the Supreme Court and the fight and how to fight back against its anti-worker and anti-women decisions. Remember, thinking about socialism is great. Talking with others about socialism is even better, but building a revolutionary socialist party is best of all. Good night, comrades and friends. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. You can read more at liberationnews.org. You can follow us on SoundCloud, Spotify, Spreaker, and other podcast platforms. And follow us on social media at PSL Web.